This is GabFest Radio, a weekly program about politics and culture from Slate and WNYC. On this week's Political GabFest, Biden versus Ryan, the vice presidential candidates face off in Kentucky.
Our adversaries are much more willing to test us. They're more brazen in their attacks, and our allies are less willing to...
With all due respect, that's a bunch of malarkey.
Plus, the Supreme Court revisits affirmative action. Could this be the beginning of the end? I'm Emily Bazelon.
And I'm Stephen Metcalf. On this week's Culture GabFest, Family Guy's Seth MacFarlane will host the Oscars. Is he the voice of a new generation for the end of civilization as we know it? Also, the rise of online learning with some of America's most elite universities. And finally, Pitch Perfect, the a cappella sing-off SmackDown movie you've been waiting for. Our show begins with the Political GabFest right after the news.
Hello and welcome to GabFest Radio from Slate and WNYC. I'm Slate senior editor Emily Bazelon, filling in for David Plotz. I'm here in New York, sort of oddly, with John Dickerson, Slate's political correspondent and the CBS political director. Did I say that right?
You did,
more
Emily.
Or less.
Hi.
Good.
Yes.
Hi. And we have a special guest, Jacob Weisberg, editor-in-chief of the Slate Group. I probably messed that up, too.
Not a bit. Emily, I'm delighted to be here in the Plotz chair, but not with the Plotz personality.
That's right. A different personality is with us this morning.
Okay. Cheers go up from listeners everywhere.
No, sadness.
I love the Plotz personality.
We like your personality, too, though. We are going to talk about the Biden-Ryan debate, of course, and we're going to close with the Supreme Court's big affirmative action case this week. We all watched the debate last night. I only fell asleep for the last 5 minutes. And, John, you wrote this morning, and you had a great line saying that Biden was both Ryan's opponent and the guy in the Barca lounger who was spluttering mightily as the debate progressed. So was this effective, or was it just, like, over-the-top Bidenisms?
I think, as Bill Clinton used to say, false choice. I think both are true. I think it was effective in the way, in the sense that Democrats loved to see Biden doing all the things they wished Obama had done. You know, the traditional role of the vice president or the vice presidential candidate in campaigns is to play the attack dog. And they can do that because they have a little more room to roam than the candidate at the top of the ticket who has to kind of look presidential. Biden didn't have to look presidential. And so he was all over Ryan and Romney. He didn't. There's an old line attributed also to Clinton that, you know, the other guy can't talk when you've got your fist in his mouth. And he was just interrupting Biden. He was interrupting Raddatz. He was interrupting himself. He was just both in word, sigh, aside, and the smiles and antics he was doing while Ryan was talking controlled the debate in a way that thrills Democrats who want the campaign to kind of call out the Romney campaign for being phonies. So I think it was good sucker for the Democratic folks who were feeling let down. I don't think it does anything for independent voters, for swing voters, not independent voters. But the good news for the Obama campaign is swing voters are going to make their decision on the top of the ticket. And some might have even been offended by Biden, but I don't think they're going to be the ones, you know, they're going to decide on Romney versus Obama.
What did you think about Biden's laughing and smiling, Jacob? Did it come across as charming or smirky to you? I was on the smirking side of the ledger.
Oh, really? Well, I think the question with Biden is always, is he world's greatest ham actor, or is he just unusually in touch with his authentic self? You know, and I sort of think he was the ham actor last night. I mean, he was very consciously goading Ryan, trying to produce a reaction. And Ryan, to his credit, kept his cool. I mean, because anytime he reacted to something Biden said, you know, Biden was ready with the second punch. He was setting up Ryan at every turn. But, you know, it was theater. Look, I mean, hanging his head, you know, rolling his eyes, throwing his head back and laughing. And that was very calculated, too. He knew where the cameras were. You know, he knew that when Ryan was talking, people were also going to be seeing him visually undermining what Ryan was saying.
Yeah, that's true. So I thought his weakest moment in terms of substance, and I'm talking now about Biden, was on Libya. And that's because the administration really is vulnerable about this changing story. What did you guys think about that?
I agree. I think clearly his weakest moment, it's the administration's weakest moment right now, because their stories keep changing. And they have two problems. They have either they didn't know what was going on, which is bad, or they did know what was going on and they were misleading people. And you know, this campaign will be decided on the economy, but to the extent that Romney has available to him an argument that the president is kind of out of ideas, not really in control of things. Libya plays into that. And I think the juxtaposition of four dead in Libya and the kind of jokey Joe could be a problem. I think in the way the debate played out, Biden's answer, which was also newsmaking, he said we didn't know that this was not related to the film for a little while. I think there's contradictory evidence from testimony in Congress that, in fact, they did know that this was a terrorist attack early on. He also blamed the intelligence agencies, which is a very dangerous thing to do, as President Bush learned, because the intelligence agencies who did, in fact, report on this early as being a terrorist event leaked to reporters. And I think you could very well see if they want to push back against the idea that they screwed up, a kind of war fought out in the papers between the administration, or I should say Joe Biden, and the intelligence community. But the good news for Biden was that this came at the very beginning, and then the debate went in an entirely different direction.
And, John, he had a very good answer, which was you, Ryan, voted to cut $300 million from embassy security, which Ryan didn't have a good answer to. I mean, I thought that was an effective line. I mean, Ryan was good on foreign policy, but he had a little bit of a whiff of the cram session about him. You know, he had a lot of – he wanted to prove he knew it. And this is an issue with foreign policy and presidential campaigns. The challenger always formulates his views in relation to the incumbent, right? So it would have been very hard to say what a Romney-Ryan foreign policy would have been outside the context of the campaign. Inside the context of the campaign, it's that Obama's doing everything wrong. And part of the problem is if you get elected, you're then committed to all of these positions that you took for political reasons.
And also you can be a purist. You can talk about, you know, American power and never compromising as if, like, these are easy things in the real world. Whereas when you go in and govern, of course, like, you're going to end up in this more mushy position. Right?
And what does it mean on Iran, for example? I mean, Ryan's bluff was called a little bit on that. Okay, be tougher. What,
war?
Do you think the sanctions aren't working? What's between sanctions, which you support, and war, which you don't support? How is your policy actually different?
And he didn't really have an answer on that,
no.
Right? As opposed to his comeback about the 10% unemployment rate in Scranton, which I actually thought was his best moment. That was like a very planted, calculated line that I thought worked well.
Right. In terms of Biden giving the Democrats what they wanted, there was one moment in which Biden hit on both the 47%, Romney's comments that the housing market would just kind of have to run its course, the foreclosures would just have to keep going, and letting Detroit go bankrupt, which is the headline of the New York Times op-ed that Romney wrote, which didn't exactly send that message, but the headline did. Put all three of those in like a single sentence.
And his parents, right?
Yeah,
and his neighbors.
Yeah, it was like a peanut cluster of attacks. And Ryan was good to come back with, you know, his 10% was kind of – it was the answer to the 47%. But I thought if you looked at that exchange and how it played out a little while after, as you mentioned, Emily, Biden talked about, you know, the 47% are my mom and dad. And then he talked about veterans. And then he talked about people on fixed incomes. And it was a very emotional, passionate performance in defense of the middle class. That's what, you know, Biden's excessive antic behavior could arguably – all be explained as in the service of trying to defend the middle class, which is obviously that's the sort of best Obama case for what Biden did. What Ryan found himself doing often was defending Mitt Romney. And if that was the dynamic that people took from the debate, then that's, you know, exactly where the Obama people want this campaign to be. We're going to fight and be passionate about the middle class and then keep the other guys on the defensive.
And then Ryan, his way of dealing with this is to say, we want everyone to succeed. We want the economy to grow. We want everyone to climb up the ladder. It has a kind of abstract feeling to me, though. I wonder if people hearing it identify with it or feel like it's what a politician would say who doesn't have, like, real meat on the bones.
Well, part of Biden's greatness as a ham actor is that he does have this bond with the middle class. You know, he can stand there in a, you know, $2,000 suit looking like a senator, but say, you know, expressing himself in a way that middle class really does relate to. And he sees himself as one of them. And I think he gets that across. You know, and that's what was so effective. I mean, after the presidential debate where Obama left all his supporters starving, you know, he's a skinny man who leaves people hungry for, you know, for some kind of passion. You know, Biden supplied that, this passionate defense of just liberal programs of Social Security, of Medicare. I mean, that could have been expressed by any Democratic candidate in any campaign for the past 60 years. But damn it, people want it. And he, you know, he gave it to them.
Right. He's like the credible middle class defender, and Ryan is the very credible wonk, which has some advantages, but I'm not sure it played out as effectively on television.
I was just going to interject. You know, the wonk thing with Ryan is a constant source of fascination, but his wonkiness, well, it's two things. One, in preparations beforehand, they were worried he would get too wonky, and he tried. They sort of coached him on telling stories, and so there were a couple of moments. In fact, one where he told a moving story about Mitt Romney helping a family whose kids had two of whom had been paralyzed in a car accident, and paying for the college education of the kids. Which was a story about Mitt Romney, but he also tried to tell stories about people in the middle class who were suffering. The wonkiness should be, for a candidate, you know the details, and you can use precision details to make your point and to dismantle your opponent. But Ryan has run from specifics, and so has Mitt Romney, in such a way with this campaign that those specifics are not available to them, and so the wonkiness doesn't pay off at all. There's no way to harness that energy, which they should be able to. He's a guy who knows how the numbers work. He can make a plausible case. One of the things they found in the first debate for Mitt Romney was that in the focus groups, people lost control or didn't know what he was talking about when it got really technical and into the policy, but they felt he knew what he was talking about. And I'm not sure that came across as well for Ryan, who presumably knows more about the ins and outs of the budget than Mitt Romney.
Right. It's like as if he's been sort of muzzled because they don't want to go in that direction.
I thought that Ryan anecdote was actually an appalling moment that Biden didn't really pick up on. The idea that a rich presidential candidate writing a check to people who've had this terrible tragedy in their lives is some kind of admirable way of dealing with it. I mean, to me, that was an opportunity for Biden to say, you know, look, you know, personal charity is not a way to deal with things that happen to people, and people need a safety net and they need guaranteed health care. You know, and I found it a very kind of, I don't know, indicative of Romney's view of the world in a way that's not appealing. Biden kind of let that one go.
But Ryan's point wasn't this is how we should take care of people. It was that Romney has a good heart, so judge him not by his 47%, but by his personal behavior in this instance. And it wasn't just that he wrote the check. He was clear to say he spent all this time with the family, and that was what amazed them so much, is that he was, you know, he was visiting and volunteering and helping out the family in ways that were different than the check he wrote.
But those two things are connected, John, right? I mean, if your ideology is that it's bad that so many people depend on government support and government services, and then, you know, your way of dealing with people who need that help is to be generous personally. Yes, you're generous personally, but politically, it's a sad position.
I thought it was a weird moment, too, because obviously Biden has a story of his family members killed in a car crash, yeah. And he brought that up. But Ryan, it would have been such an easy and smart, I think, thing for Ryan to sort of bracket in a way that acknowledged that. And I was, knowing that background, I was like a little bit uncomfortable wondering how that would play out. I think it was disastrous. Right?
Yeah, I think though. Imagine, I mean, he was trying to be a character witness for Romney.
Yes.
And I think if you bring Biden's own personal tragedy into it, I think it just gets messy. But when you talk about car crashes, you kind of want to choose another anecdote in the Mitt Romney file because of Biden's own personal history.
Right, yeah. Perhaps that's the answer. All right, the next presidential debate is a town hall format on Tuesday evening, October 16th. Coming up, the High Court takes up affirmative action again. You're listening to GabFest Radio from Slate and WNYC. This is GabFest Radio. I'm Emily Bazelon, along with John Dickerson and Jacob Weisberg, and this is the political GabFest portion of the show. Let's turn to the Supreme Court, where I went this week to watch oral argument in a huge case about affirmative action in college admissions. It's called Fisher versus the University of Texas at Austin. And Abigail Fisher is a white applicant to the University of Texas who sued after she didn't get in 2008. She says she didn't get in because of the university's affirmative action policy. And this is how UT actually does its admissions. Most of the students, like up to 80% of the class, get in through what's called the top 10% plan. They're just automatically admitted because they were in the top 10% of their high school classes. And there's some racial and ethnic diversity that comes out of that because of the way Texas, like most places, has housing segregation. So you have high schools that are predominantly black, and so the black kids get in that way. But then there are these leftover 20% or so of the class, and those slots are given out based on a combination of academics and what's called the Personal Achievement Index. And that index has in it leadership and community service and socioeconomic background, and it also includes race. So this is the sticking point for Abigail Fisher, and it seemed to me, watching oral argument, that it was also very much the sticking point for the court's conservatives, who seemed skeptical that universities should be using any kind of consideration of race in making admissions decisions. So this is a big switch from the last time the court had affirmative action before it in 2003, right? Yeah, 9 years ago, when the court essentially approved an affirmative action policy at the University of Michigan, which actually does more in taking race into account than UT is doing. So what has shifted here? Is this just like we don't have Sandra Day O'Connor on the court anymore? We have Samuel Alito? Or is there something that really has changed that would justify the Supreme Court changing its mind?
Well, Emily, I wanted to just ask you to explain the Supreme Court politics, because I know that Elena Kagan has recused herself. I'm actually not sure why that is. But what does that mean in terms of the math and the lower court decision and a tie upholding it? And, you know, what's the practicality?
So it probably won't mean much. Kagan didn't say why she recused herself. Presumably she worked on this case in some way when she was the Solicitor General. So there are 8 members. They could split 4-4 if Kennedy votes with the liberals on the court. If that happened, the lower court ruling allowing for what UT is doing would be upheld. But what's more likely, just watching them, is that it'll be 5-3 in favor of knocking down affirmative action. And in that case, it wouldn't really matter whether Kagan was there or not.
You know, I first started writing about politics in the mid-'80s, and people were having almost exactly the same argument about university admissions and affirmative action. And I will say it makes me a little weary. I mean, in the meantime, empires have risen and fallen. You know, revolutions have happened. We live in a different world, but we're still having the same damn argument about affirmative action. It's frustrating, isn't it?
But aren't we still having the same argument? Because we still have this problem, which is lower achievement among African-American and Hispanic students for a host of reasons, a lot of which are structural and have to do with the crappy high schools that they go to, and that we're still trying to make up for that damage, essentially.
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned that, Jacob, because when I first went to report in Washington in the mid-'90s, we were doing this whole thing too, and Clinton was trying to find his own way to answer these questions. Emily, I want to ask you, what if a school wants to take race into account as a part of just having a diversified body, not to correct for the social ills, but just because any institution, public or private, wants to have a well-rounded, representative, racially, ethnically diverse population?
So that is UT's justification for this policy. It is, in fact, the only legal justification that's left, because the Supreme Court took off the table in 2003 compensating for historical disadvantage. So what UT says, what all these schools say, is, look, for reasons of educational mission, we need to have a really diverse class, and that class needs to include kids of all ethnicities and races from all different classes, class backgrounds, socioeconomic backgrounds. It was that last part that seemed to really be bothering Justice Kennedy this week. And he is absolutely the swing vote in this case. He kind of waited, held his cards to his vest for a while. And then when he spoke, he said, you know, it seems to me that what's happening, one aspect of this policy is that you are bumping ahead wealthier African-American and Hispanic students over poorer white students. And Alito really ran with this idea and said, basically, look, what if you have a black student who's in the top 1% in terms of wealth? Do you really think that person should be favored over a white student who he called absolutely average? It's a hard question.
Well, isn't it a mix? I mean, because presumably then it's in the discretion of the admissions advisors to say, you know, we want a mix of race and socioeconomic background. And so if the one percenter, if the way they've figured it, the Rubik's Cube out, you know, that we feel like we've got enough from this socioeconomic background but not enough from this racial, that it's kind of a part of the general mix.
Yeah, that is totally the answer. And the question is whether it's still a good enough answer. I mean, mm-hmm. I think that it is, because we don't live in a post-racial society, in my view. And also because you have to have all these different kinds of kids in the class as a whole. And then I also feel like there's this underlying question, which is, look, these universities are begging to do this. All the Fortune 100 companies and small businesses and retired military leaders who weighed in this case, all in favor of let them keep trying to promote diversity on campus. Why do we really need the courts to step in here?
Well, Emily, but I think that the comment you were citing points to the way in which the world has changed or is changing even as the debate stays basically the same. You know, at some point, class is going to be a bigger divide in America than race. You might argue that point is now. You might argue that's in 20 years. But clearly, income inequality, the division is a huge issue. And at the same time, we have had tremendous racial progress. You have the issue of upper-class African Americans, which was a much smaller phenomenon 30 or 40 years ago. And you have an increasingly multiracial society in which people who we might identify as African American or Asian or Latino identify themselves in more complicated ways. So, you know, at some point, I think this argument that class-based affirmative action is more sensible and responds to the social ill we're trying to mitigate more effectively than race-based, I think is right.
The Supreme Court will rule on affirmative action by June. We will surely get to talk about it by then. But now, it's time for cocktail chatter. Jacob, what are you going to be thinking about over the weekend, over drinks, if you're lucky enough to have one?
Well, I certainly plan to, Emily. I was in London last week, and they were having both political party conferences. And I have to say, British politics right now is completely delightful. It's dominated by two rivalries. On the Labour Party side, it's these two brothers, David and Ed Miliband, who ran against each other for the party leadership, and Ed Miliband, the unexpected brother, won. And on the Republican side, it's David Cameron and Boris Johnson, who are old friends, went to college together, were in the same elitist club at Oxford, and clearly have this seething rage competition against each other. And Boris Johnson is the most entertaining politician probably on the world scene today. And his speech at the party conference they had last week was a series of sort of inside jokes and double entendres, sort of making fun of David Cameron, who's the party leader who everyone thinks he might challenge at some point. And it's just really fun right now.
That's excellent. I love what an Anglophile you are, Jacob. As long as you don't actually get up and move to London, it's an excellent attribute.
Would have perished the thought.
John, what are you thinking about this weekend?
Well, you know, it's an expensive cocktail chatter I'm talking about, but there is Facts on File, which is one of my favorite publications before the internet, when you needed to find out the facts about something that had happened. These wonderful volumes of information about political events and historical events that had happened. Well, they've now put out a 3-volume edition of every election since the first one in this country. And one of the editors of the 3-huge-volume edition is this guy, Gil Troy, who I've mentioned before, who I just think is fantastic. He wrote a book called See How They Ran about the history of campaigning. This is just – it's fantastic, wonderful, rich history, great detail, nicely laid out. And so if you're a political junkie or no one – it's like $200, so that's a little steep price, but it is invaluable and great fun to read, but also just a super resource.
And you must be a political junkie or no one if you're listening to this show. So
right, that's right.
It's an early Christmas Hanukkah present.
It comes down to just pennies per fact.
A deal, a bargain. My cocktail chatter is about 2 magazine pieces that came out this week, or one is about to come out, I think, by 2 of my favorite writers. My friend Nadia Labi has this excellent piece about a hitman and a wrongful conviction involving him in The New Yorker this week. It's a great read. You should totally check it out. And Pam Koloff, who's just done amazing work on criminal justice, she's a real investigative reporter, has a piece coming out in the Texas Monthly about a conviction gone awry there that also is very much worth reading. That'll do it for the Political Gabfest portion of the show. I'm Emily Bazelon in New York, handing off to you, Stephen.
I'm Stephen Metcalf, and this is the Slate Culture Gabfest. On today's program, Pitch Perfect, the new movie comedy about an a cappella singing group. Sounds incredibly stale. It isn't, I don't think. And then we'll talk about Seth MacFarlane. Is he taking over the known universe? And finally, Al Filreis of the University of Pennsylvania joins us to talk MOOC, Massive Open Online Courses, which are now available at some of the country's best universities. Joining me today is Slate's deputy editor, Julia Turner. Hello, Julia.
Hi, Steve.
And Slate's film critic, Dana Stevens. Hey, Dana.
Hey, Steve.
Dana, I'm going to start with you. Pitch Perfect is a new comedy. It's directed by Jason Moore, who's known for directing Broadway shows, Avenue Q, and I believe Les Miserables was one time under his direction. It's written by Kay Cannon, who's best known for writing for 30 Rock. I said in my intro, you know, at first blush, it sounds incredibly stale. It's a story of a college a cappella singing group, all-girl singing group called the Bellas, and their quest to win a national championship or something. It's structured along utterly traditional lines. Nonetheless, did you find the movie fresh, interesting, different? What'd you think of it?
I don't think I found it as fresh as you did. It doesn't sound like. I mean, my story with Pitch Perfect, I went in planning to review it, and I left the movie and thought, I honestly have nothing to say about that movie. It was fun, it was cute, it was bouncy, and it disappeared the moment I stopped watching it. And I didn't write about it. And I have nothing to say about it right now.
This is a rich vein that I hope to mine, a conversational vein I hope to mine in a second. But, Julia, in my defense, I'm not the only person who was semi-rapturous about the film. I mean, it is what it is. You're not meant to, you know, take it with you to the grave. But it's David Edelstein of New York Magazine loved the film in the same way that I think I kind of loved it. I thought it was buzzy and really fun, and it took something that's totally stale and made it just delightful. What do you think?
Well, of course I loved this movie. I'm like built by robots to love this movie. I am categorically a fan of almost all performance competition-based films. If you are in a small, scrappy troupe that must master your performance in order to win the competition at the end of the film, then I will almost certainly like your film. But I'm much more surprised and intrigued by the fact that Steve liked this movie, and I want to hear a lot more about that. But before we go back to Steve, let's listen to a clip.
That brings out the man in me. I know I can help myself. You're all in the world to me. It feels like the first time.
I will say Anna Kendrick was great in the center role as this kind of would-be DJ who scorns a cappella groups until she's, for reasons that are unclear to me, kind of psyched into joining one and then becomes the motivational force for them to change.
Yeah, I would say I don't know that I was especially familiar with her before going to see the movie. I do think she's really good.
You've seen her in Up in the Air, right?
It's true. I mean, reminded of that fact, I now remember that she was in it, but I didn't have, you know, Anna Kendrick name recognition going into the movie, though now I really like her. I'm a fan. But and I'll tell you what I liked about it, a couple things. One is I love the idea that the framework of a film is totally irrelevant to its final quality, that it's like saying, all sonnets are 14 lines long. You say nothing about the quality of an individual sonnet by pointing out its rhyme scheme, its length of 14, that it turns after the eighth line to the final quatrain or whatever, nothing. In other words, there's a false value placed on originality and novelty, partially because in the realm of Hollywood movies, it makes them extremely marketable, right? The hot concept, the one-sentence pitch that eventually goes on the movie poster. I love the fact that, A, this is a mid-budget movie, which is disappearing. The mid-budget comedy that isn't star-driven, I should say, has virtually disappeared from the landscape. A movie that you make for under $50 million and gets by on its own charms. And B, it's very low concept. I mean, to the extent that it has any concept at all, we've seen it a million times, as Julia points out already. What sells this movie is the pep, the zest of the musical performances. As someone who has no affection for a cappella singing, I actually thought that these were kind of cool, because one of the things the movie asserts over and over again, and I think quite successfully, is that the reason why this girl group is in danger, women's group is in danger of losing the competition, is that they do a cappella in this boring, stale way, and something of the hip-hop sensibility, or whatever you want to call it, kind of DJ mashup sensibility, is being brought into what they're doing. That's actually, I think, quite convincing. And then secondly, it's just funny. It's just well done. It has wit, which I wasn't expecting at all. And in fact, it's rare that this crusty, old sub-intellectual goes to a movie on Columbus Day and therefore is surrounded by a bunch of high school students, and we all laugh at the same thing. It was totally a refreshing experience. They thought it was hilarious, and I thought it was hilarious. It's just funny.
You are warming the cockles of my heart, Steve, with your love for this movie. Yeah, I agree. I think there was some charm and elan in the execution, and particularly in the performances and the cast. I'm an Anna Kendrick fan. I also think Rebel Wilson, who's an actress we saw as the weird roommate, Kristen Wiig's weird roommate in Bridesmaids, and also in the recent movie Bachelorette, is an incredibly funny comedian. She plays a character called Fat Amy in this movie, which she says in the film she calls herself Fat Amy to prevent skinny girls from calling her that behind her back. And then I also am a longtime fan of Anna Camp, who plays the uptight and controlling a cappella leader who wants them to sing yet another unspirited rendition of Ace of Base's I Saw the Sign for the 6,000th time, rather than getting into the cool mashup culture that Anna Kendrick promises to bring to blow the a cappella world wide open. So those were the things I liked about it. I will say I have one caveat, which is, and this is something that I hope all directors of performance-based competition films will take to heart, because I'm sure they're all listening right now. It's important to me when you watch these movies that you see the group's transition from struggling with whatever their initial problem was, stodginess in this case, to finding their new winning style. This was a little bit too much of the flash cut situation.
Completely agree, Julia. And for me, that actually did, to some extent, ruin the movie. It needs more rehearsal. It needs more process. I don't want to see a movie about people working to change their performance style and completely radically changing the way they sing without a little bit of rehearsal footage. There were a lot of catfights at rehearsals and kind of like comedy among the girls and fighting about what kind of songs they should sing. But you never really saw them building up their new style. Oh, and I couldn't stand the vomit jokes. And although Rebel Wilson is a very talented comedian, I found the fat jokes kind of offensive. Mm-hmm. I thought she was there to be like the fat girl who was the butt of jokes. I don't know, maybe I was just in a cranky mood when I saw this movie, but I saw all the things it was trying to do, enjoyed the performances, enjoyed the music, but all in all, just sort of felt like I had watched, I don't know, an episode of Glee.
I find Rebel Wilson so charming. I felt like she owned those jokes and they didn't bother me. There were, on the other hand, some Asian jokes that I thought were problematic. The movie definitely skirted the line of offensive humor in a way that I mostly gave it a pass for because I was having so much fun, but I'm not sure I'd like to think about it too hard. All right, a cappella question for you guys. Did either of you ever try out for or participate in an a cappella group of any kind in your undergraduate years? And or what is your favorite song to sing?
I know I essentially sprinted across the Berkeley campus whenever the a cappella groups would appear outside to begin their Lambert, Hendricks, and Ross covers or whatever they were singing. I'd never joined an a cappella group.
What were the names of the a cappella groups also is a crucial factor.
Oh, I wish I remembered. The Treblemakers actually is a great name, the name of the boys group in this movie. I totally love the name the Treblemakers, but I do not remember my campus's group names.
Steve?
I fronted an all-girl a cappella singing group in college, and I was known for Tracks of My Tears. I mean, what a preposterous question. Are you kidding? Like, I was listening to Africa Bambaataa and planning on how to, like, blow up the entire university quietly in my dorm room. The idea of me going and trying out for the Whiff and Poofs, Julia, I'm afraid you're fired.
Just trying to see if I can elicit any confessions out of you guys.
Throwing it back at you?
Oh, no, I can't sing. I never did that. I did have a friend who was in the Cheddar Tux and did a mean Michael Jackson. But no.
How can something so – I mean, look, this is just to open up an entirely new avenue of discussion right at the end of the segment. But how can something so incredibly niche and dorky as a cappella singing be having a moment? Like, how is that possible? Julia, in 10 seconds or less.
Glee.
Okay, there we go. Good. Coming up, will the internet contaminate our finest universities? You're listening to GabFest Radio from Slate and WNYC. This is GabFest Radio. I'm Stephen Metcalf, along with Dana Stevens and Julia Turner, and this is the Culture GabFest portion of the show. Al Filreis is the Kelly Professor of English at the University of Pennsylvania and the Faculty Director of the Kelly Writers House. He also, I should say, is my academic fairy godfather. He is teaching MODPO, modern poetry, to 33,000 people.
Yeah, almost 34,000.
Via the internet. Al, is it fair to say that, to a degree, you've become the poster boy for MOOC, for Massive Open Online Courses, by which it's now possible to take lecture classes, take quizzes, participate in discussions, even if you yourself are not a registered student at the University of Pennsylvania, where you teach, or Stanford, or any of the variety of institutions that are now doing this? I've heard your voice recently on NPR on it. You're the man who's being put
the
forward to sell this.
The reason I was the poster boy is I'm the doggy in the window of the humanities. You know, so I'm the first one to try it in the humanities. So the people who really pioneered it were in engineering, and they were using the platform in a way that a humanist wouldn't go near, which is to say quizzes where there's a correct answer, assignments that can be auto-graded. Once I heard the pitch from these two fabulous people from Stanford, academics who
who wanted to try this. I raised my hand and I said, this is impossible for the humanities. It's impossible. We need qualitative responses. We're going to need a sense of community. There needs to be some discussion. And I can't lecture. I don't lecture. And this whole format set is set up for lecture. And these wonderful people led by Daphne Koller said, we'll fix the system for you. You tell us what you need. And they spent all summer doing that. So what I'm doing is a pilot in the humanities. And that's why Guy Raz of NPR was interested in that.
And so tell me what the class consists of. So what if I'm taking your class, what do I do in a given week?
So what you'll do, Julia, is read a poem. Then you'll watch a 10 to 20 minute video of me with 8 of my students talking about the poem, doing a collaborative, collective, close reading. With that model, you will then of a close reading, you will then go into a discussion forum, which is familiar to all of us. It's you post comments, you can get replies. There are threads. It's organized. You can vote up. It's kind of like liking. And you discuss the poem. And I myself and my TAs are in the discussion forums contributing to the discussion. Then once a week, you'll tune into a live webcast session where you'll see me and my students, and we'll talk about the poems some more. So each week, we do a segment of modern and contemporary American poetry. You can do it at your own pace within that given week. If you miss the week, you can go back and do it later.
And just so I'm clear, are you teaching this same class simultaneously to the 33,000 folks online and to your students
at
Penn?
It happens that I am. But that's just an accident of scheduling. ModPo is not being taught out of that other class. It's a separate entity.
I see.
Although I have to say that my teaching of the face-to-face class at Penn is already benefiting from the materials that I've been gathering together to teach ModPo.
And so what is the accreditation model for these online courses through Coursera?
Free,
for the moment, they're all non-credit courses, right?
Right?
And so what is – I mean, this is, I guess, the big question, right, for universities, is what's in it for the universities to set up these courses through Coursera and have 30,000 people taking a Stanford course or a Penn course? I mean, there's no revenue model for
I
the moment.
I hear skepticism
but
in your tone.
Somebody's got to play the devil's advocate here.
Hips.
Hey, I'm enrolled in your class, so I'm actually really enjoying it. I watched some of your lecture on Whitman yesterday. Well, I guess you wouldn't call it a lecture. Your interactive
you
collaborative reading.
Right? Yeah.
And it was fantastic.
Yeah.
I mean, the level that you're able to maintain with, you know,
right,
this number of
so
students was impressive.
So the people these people came, you know what they said to us, which is, do you want to be part of this thing? Do you want to be known as a university that really is willing to take down the ivy-covered walls that separate those who pay $57,000 a year from those who don't? Are you interested in, if we structure, are you interested in disseminating the knowledge of your faculty to get a good reputation? Maybe there's a 17-year-old in Montana, I know there is, taking my course, who's interested in understanding what goes on at Penn, is interested in the writer's house, is interested in modern poetry, and is going to present a PDF certificate, which is essentially worthless, except that it's a way for him to demonstrate that he went through and completed this course. So probably they'll eventually charge $10 or $15 for the certificate itself, but no tuition. And probably they'll engage some employers in the engineering, the STEM areas, science, technology, engineering, math, where they're looking for people who are far-flung, who have skill sets that we can't tap into. Probably Coursera will eventually charge employers a kind of fee for searching those who opt in to be essentially put their resumes up on Coursera. There's a revenue stream. Other than that, I really don't think that they have any idea. What's the revenue stream for this podcast?
All we know is that it's massive and viscously flowing at all times.
So you just started teaching this for the first time like 4 or 5 weeks ago, right?
Yeah, that's right.
So what surprised you most about the process and in particular about your interactions with these far-flung students?
I'm surprised at how moved I am by some of the students' stories. I'm having more fun teaching this than ever, and I hope not too many of my face-to-face students are listening because I love that. I've been doing that for 30 years and never going to give it up. But let me just give you an example. There's an 81-year-old named Mr. Teleonis. I don't know his first name. He's in Athens. He's got a major heart problem, and his doctors have told him he can't go out. But one thing he can do is study poetry. He's always wanted to do it. So he's my buddy. And he actually emails me, which is a problem when you've got 33,000 students, but he emails me, I can't figure out the site. Here's my paper on Emily Dickinson. It's a week late. And he tells me about his heart condition. So I post it to the discussion forum on his behalf, and I explain Mr. Teleonis is 81 years old. He's shut in. Can you look at his paper? Well, 180 people Now, out of 33,000, that's a lot, not a lot. But for Mr. Teleonis, one response would have been a big deal. 180 people responded to this man's essay on Emily Dickinson. And then there's Sarah in Cape Town, who's got fibroneuralgia. She can't really move, and she doesn't move at a fast pace. And she was told she can't go to school because she can't keep up. And so she's got no education and no access. And she is just, when she told her story in one of the live webcasts, there wasn't a dry eye in the house. I feel attached to my student sitting in front of me this afternoon at 1:30 at Penn, who's got a whole set of post-adolescent problems and is really sort of using this course as a way of understanding herself. But I feel attached to Sarah, too, even though I've never met her and probably never will.
Well, Al, thank you so much for coming on the program. That was a totally convincing spiel.
So why am I your godfather?
You're my academic fairy godfather.
Okay.
Because you hooked me up. You hooked me up with poetry. All right, thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you.
Al Filreis, University of Pennsylvania.
They will make you take a tinkle when you want to take a piss.
And they'll make you call fellatio a trouser-friendly kiss.
Here's the plain situation. There's no negotiation with the fellas at the freaking FCC.
Seth MacFarlane is probably best known for creating the animated television series Family Guy. He also wrote and directed the movie and voiced the part of Ted in the movie Ted, which made a ton of money. Family Guy is a huge hit. He has various other animated shows for Fox TV. He is, according to Wikipedia, he is the world's highest paid television writer. And now he's going to be the host for the next Oscars. And also, Julia, did you know what else he has done?
What else has he done?
He has recorded an album of American standards from the songbook.
I did know that, actually.
Yeah. Have you heard it?
I have not. Anyway, I clutch it to my chest as you clutch the Bring It On DVD to yours.
In order to make sure it never makes it onto your CD player?
Possibly.
Anyway, so tell me why we're talking about Seth MacFarlane.
Here's my theory about why we should talk about Seth MacFarlane. For years now, the thinking person in America has been able to ignore the fact that Seth MacFarlane and his shows exist and to ignore the entire oeuvre of Seth MacFarlane and to basically just write off all of that dreck as ignorable, right? But now he's, like, going to be up in our faces. His movies are creeping up onto the box office. He's going to be dancing around and singing the American Songbook on the Oscar stage come this February or March or whenever the Oscars are this year. So we thought it was time to reckon with this guy's work, figure out what the heck it is. So we all watched some episodes of his TV shows. Dana, what do you make of the oeuvre of Seth MacFarlane?
All right. So like you guys, I was one of the ignorers. I think I was mainly aware of Family Guy because it's on right before The Simpsons, right? Or right after The Simpsons. I know that when tuning in to watch The Simpsons, I would sometimes accidentally catch a few minutes of Family Guy. And I would always try to keep my daughter from seeing any of it because it's just such a mean, nasty feeling show. To me, it's just the spirit that it channels is such a negative one that dirty jokes or you know, sort of offensive jokes aside, I just sort of didn't want her to have that worldview in her brain. And more extended exposure to Seth MacFarlane has done nothing to change my vision. I really, really dislike Family Guy.
Well, this is the mystery. Okay, so I live in a completely 100% Seth MacFarlane-free universe. And to the extent that he ever creeps in at all, I always repel him with the thought, very poor man's Simpsons. So I sat down. I said, okay, well, with an open mind, I'll watch Family Guy. I picked one episode from season two, one episode from season three, so probably when it was still in its heyday. It really is god-awful. It's ghastly. It's some of the worst television I've ever seen. It is so witless and mean-spirited and vacuous. You truly wonder at the people who tune into this over and over and over again. And yet I have to admit, like, there's something unstoppable about Seth MacFarlane. I don't know that I can identify what part of his creative personality it is that connects with what part of the American public. But you sense that standing in its way is an invitation to get crushed somehow, Julia, right? That there's something inexorable about this guy. You know, he himself I saw him host one of the roasts on television, and he was as unstintingly unfunny as his own television show. But there's something kind of Cat Ate the Canary, self-possessed kind of, you know, he doesn't look like a troll-like comedy writer in a way. He has this sort of superficial palatability or something. And you just sense, you know, look, the universe is going to flatter him and it's going to squash me. So I guess I just have to accept it. It's like deciding you don't like Mao Zedong and you live in a canton in China in, you know, 1960. I mean, what are your options, really?
Yeah. Oh, I think you're completely overestimating the cultural power of Seth MacFarlane. I think that is a completely odd, freakish thing that he was chosen to host the Oscars that makes me wonder whether nobody wants that job anymore. I mean, honestly, if you're going to dig into the TV world of kind of standard singing, song and dance men, why not Neil Patrick Harris?
Mm-hmm. Although, I don't know, I saw Seth MacFarlane, my first exposure to the rising star or rising visibility of Seth MacFarlane, the man himself, and not just his work this year, came when he hosted Saturday Night Live. And he did that in what some people have said was like a tryout or at least a showcase that let the Oscar host see what he was capable of. And I was surprised to find him to be a plausible and charming-ish person. I agree that there's some callowness and thinness in his jokes and there's a mean-spiritedness in the shows that bothers me. But, you know, he's like handsome for a TV writer. He can sing. He was kind of funny. He was sort of self-deprecating. Like he has the... He has, like, the facade of a Neil Patrick Harris without any of the warmth or charm. And that's the crazy thing about the shows, too, right? Like, what is different about these shows from South Park or The Simpsons or some of the other kind of irreverent animated comics for grown-ups that have, you know, risen to the top of the TV heap in the last 20 or 25 years? You know, there's a lot of pop culture references like The Simpsons. There's a lot of elaborate jokes. There's a lot of violence that comes to no consequence in the same way that, you know, it often does on South Park. There's many of the same elements. Also, I watched an episode. I actually watched recent episodes. I watched the season premieres of Family Guy and American Dad this year. Family Guy seemed to me to be completely worthless. I mean, literally, there was like a PMS joke.
Oh, we don't need a map, Brian. I got us a GPMS machine.
Go up. What do you think? Just go up.
Sorry.
Okay, can everyone just stop freaking out and just give me, like, 2 minutes? God! Everyone's always yelling at me when all the questions!
All right, well, maybe we'll turn you on later and see how you feel. She was so nice in the store.
Okay, it's misogynistic on this basic formative level. It's not even like you can pick out the misogynistic jokes in Family Guy. It's just built on a whole structure of misogyny.
A whole level of, yeah, naggy wife and whatever. It's like the structures that he's created are very familiar, and yet there's just this thin, sad meanness within them.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the richness of humanity and human experience that underlies The Simpsons compared to what you see when you watch Family Guy, it's just, it's they don't even inhabit the same universe.
Yeah. I mean, the axe I always grind is that 30 years ago, right, when this kind of moment, golden age of comedy that we're now in first started with Monty Python leaking through the United States on PBS, and all the people who created The Simpsons or were its principal writers for its best years all remember fondly tuning in at 10:30 on a Sunday night to watch Monty Python. You know, those were young university wits who were fighting against the British class system very much from the edges. I mean, they were children of privilege, though ambiguous privilege. But there was a sense that there was a dominant, serious, and adult culture that it was extremely liberating to snipe at from the margins. And what's happened is all of that has moved from the margins to the center. It is now the dominant tone of our adult discourse in this country, and yet it retains some sort of arrogant right to believe that it's irreverent when it's not. It's basically, it's the sound of a multinational corporation cashing your check, and that's in a sense why it's gotten emptier and totally pointless. All right, well, now is the time in our program where we endorse. Dana, what do you got?
All right, this week I'm going to endorse Anne Helen Petersen's Scandals of Classic Hollywood series on the wonderful website The Hairpin. They appear somewhat periodically because the author is also a professor at Whitman College, but she visits The Hairpin to summarize some of these great vintage gossip stories from the past. So some recent features have included Gary Cooper, Gloria Swanson, Dorothy Dandridge, the terrible, very sad Fatty Arbuckle sex scandal, and essentially just kind of running through all the gossip of old Hollywood. And it's beautifully written, funny, great illustrations. So accompany that on The Hairpin, and The Hairpin in general is a fabulous site.
All right, Dana, you strike me as someone who would, like, never deign to pick up an Us Weekly to pour through while you're listening to your Indonesian bird song. So tell me why you're interested in the gossip of years past if you're not interested in the gossip of today.
Hey, I'm actually interested in the gossip of today if I'm interested in the people making the bad life choices. The problem is that gossip magazines now focus entirely on boring people that I know nothing about, like reality TV stars.
Yeah, they have all these trumped up
fake famous
people.
The scandals of classic Hollywood have it going on. I mean, Lana Turner's daughter stabbing her boyfriend, Johnny Stampinato. You don't get those kind of scandals anymore.
On that note, Julia, what do you have?
Sadly this week, or happily this week, I should say, I have been so fixated on Cloud Atlas, the book I had just started when I endorsed it last week, and I will say it holds up to my initial preemptive and preliminary endorsement. But while I have been reading Cloud Atlas in the morning, I have also been eating my breakfast. And I want to pause to endorse the fine art and unsung art of cereal mixing. this is the art of taking some cereal from one box, some cereal from another box, putting them in the same bowl, mixing them with milk, and having a delicious cereal breakfast. And I think some cereals, when mixed together, become far more than the sum of the parts. And I am an advocate of Cheerios and classic sugary Kellogg's Raisin Bran. None of this total health brand stuff. I want like visible sugar crystals on my raisins. And I would argue that you put the Cheerios, which float on the bottom, and then the Raisin Bran, which sinks on the top, so that once you add the milk, gravity and buoyancy aid in the miscegenation of the cereals, and you have a very delicious breakfast. I'm also curious to hear what cereal mixing our listeners enjoy, or whether they just think I'm crazy.
This week, I am endorsing a compilation from Sarah Records. They were an indie label band back in the 80s. I don't know if they probably made it a few years into the 90s. And, you know, I'm just one of those people for whom I didn't get the memo about hip-hop because I'm old and I'm superannuated and not that bright. But I kind of tripled down on pasty white people music. And Sarah Records is this, I mean, I don't know precisely where they were located, but I'm going to say probably Manchester or something like that, sort of northern England. And they really went all in on the twee indie rock sound. But I will argue that they produced some incredible bands, the Field Mice and the Orchids. Anyway, I have to say, I love this music. I just love it. It represents everything I'm about. It represents lost empire and crumbling class prerogative and all set to jangling guitars. But I just love this music. And the Orchids, the real discovery is that Orchids is just one of the great unsung rock and roll bands of all time. And let me add that there is a compilation of the best of Sarah Records called There and Back Again Lane, which I've been listening to obsessively.
Should we go out on the Orchids?
Let's go out on the Orchids. Dana, thank you so much.
Thanks, Steve.
Julia, a total pleasure.
Thanks, Steve.
You'll find links to some of the things we talked about on today's show at wnyc.org/gabfest. And you'll find the longer podcast version of our shows in the iTunes store. Just search for Slate Podcasts. Our email address is gabfestradio@slate.com. Gabfest Radio is a production of Slate.com, which is solely responsible for its content. The producers are Mike Buolo and Dan Pashman. Our interns are Jeff Friedrich and Sally Tamarkin. The executive producer is Andy Bowers. I'm Stephen Metcalf. We'll see you next week.